Welcome back to the Access to Education podcast, where we talk about all things having to do with learning challenges and learning disabilities. When you start to suspect that your child might have a learning challenge, it can feel really overwhelming. What do you do first? Where do you go? Who do you talk to? Who can help? What is going to make a difference? Sometimes your child's school might suggest something called a psychoeducational assessment. But what is a psychoeducational assessment? How does it work? And why would someone suggest one? Or why would I even need one? These assessments can seem scary. You are already feeling overwhelmed knowing your child is struggling. Today, I'm hoping I can help you understand why this assessment is so important and what information it can help us as educators and you as parents learn about your child's amazing brain. With me today on the show is Melissa Kate. She's a psychologist and the founder and clinical director of Cornerstone Psychological Services. She has worked in the field of school and educational psychology for the past 30 years. Melissa, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I think you're doing such a service for your listeners to be able to help educate them on this topic area.
Thank you. So speaking of the topic, let's start with the first easy question. And it's not easy because I know it's an in-depth question, but can you kind of give us, and we'll talk about it more in depth as we go, but what is a psychoeducational assessment in the simplest of terms?
Well, there's different flavors of psychoed assessments and also what's also called psychological assessments. So there's different terms, but we're all trying to get at the same thing. We're trying to get at an understanding of what are the underpinnings of a child's strengths and needs, because one size doesn't fit all. It's not a question of just giving them a specific intervention that you think will work, because it may work with some kids and some not. So we like to look at it from a brain-based perspective, and we kind of look at a learning challenge as like a door that's locked in front of you. And without the right keys to figure out precisely what will unlock that door, you don't know if you're going to damage that door by using the same key, or whether you just need to stick with that key, maybe wiggle it and jiggle it a little bit more because it is on the right path to opening the door. So what this does is it helps create an inventory of where the youngster's strengths and needs are, so that more focused support and guided support can be put in place.
So when we look at the information that we get out of it, so you're talking about strengths and needs, are we talking about only strengths academically? Are we talking about strengths in terms of their ability to deal with the world around them? What are the strengths and needs that we can gather from these assessments?
Again, it depends on who's doing the assessment, but ideally, the gold standard for doing an assessment would be to make sure that you're giving an inventory of a lot of different areas. And those areas should be across things that include personal attributes. So things that maybe school doesn't bring out, but the parent or family might see at home. It also will look at the social strengths or needs of a youngster. It will also take inventory of the thinking abilities, the memory abilities, the visual motor, the fine motor, the speed, the efficiency and planning and organizational abilities, the attention need, attentional strengths and needs. And the list goes on and on. And then there's academic areas that we take stock of too. And we look at in much more depth in terms of how somebody not only reads at a foundational level or writes or does math, but the speed at which they can process information and put it together, as well as upper level application of skills. So there's tons and tons and tons of areas that an assessment should try and touch on. And of course, we can't always do everything, but it is a question of trying to hone in on the referral question of what the family's brought forth and try to be investigative in the way that we go about doing these assessments.
So that's a whole lot of, like, I'm thinking, and full disclosure, I've had them done personally on me as a child. And then as I went from high school to university, because I needed that to prove my need through university, I've done two on each of my kids, plus a third one on my eldest child because he was transitioning to school. So that was a good time to redo one because we had done it back in grade two and we needed new assessments. So I'm going to kind of ask one of two questions, and one of which I sort of know the answer to, but people listening might not know the answer. That's a lot of assessments. Is it done over a day? Is it done over 2 days? What is the kind of flow of how these assessments happen?
Well, it depends if it's done at the school level. And I was a school psychologist for 18 years. So I know what it's like to work at the field level. And I have to, you know, give my colleagues out there a lot of support and strength and admiration for what they do. It's that they're given tools and timelines. And so they're more limited in terms of how much they are allowed to give so that they can try and reach out to a broader selection and section of kids. But in a school-based system, it's usually at least two sessions with parent interviews included in parent questionnaires, included in teacher observations, and it's important to include teachers as well. If it's going to a private clinic, it's often about double that. So with us, I know we do about 10, 12 hours worth of assessment work. So it's done over 4 or 5 sessions so that we can not fatigue our kids. And I must add too, that the activities that are selected, now reading, writing, and math is not always somebody's favorite areas to be tested, but the sessions are often fun and they're age appropriate. So there's different tests depending on the age of the client and the needs of the client. And they try really hard not to frustrate clients. So it is something that has some flexibility also, because we want to make sure that we work around how much of an attention span a youngster has and how comfortable they are with the assessment process. So a lot of time is spent developing rapport before even getting into doing testing, so that we can get the most out of a kid. It's not really what we're looking for when we're trying to deal with a kid who's super anxious. We want to
you need them to perform at what is their best, right? Because that is really what you want. But I wonder too, like, as you're talking, I'm thinking about what is the conversation families should have with their child to prepare them for what they're going to do? Because they're 7, they're 8, they're 9, they're maybe in their teens. Yeah. I mean, how do we explain to our kids why we're doing this? You know, because they could say, well, I'm not good at math. Why are you going to send me to someone to see whether or not I'm good at math? So how do parents have that conversation with them about why the assessment's happening and kind of why it's important?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that what we tend to do is we try to speak quite casually with kids and not scare them off. We say to parents, talk about the fact that everybody learns differently, and you can give different examples in your own family. Maybe somebody's artistic, somebody's very good mechanically, or whatever. And so assessments are like a wellness checkup. It helps us look at all the factors that we're good at and things that we might need help with. And by knowing that, knowledge is power. So everybody's on the same side. The teacher, the parents, and the student are on more aware of what's needed to be more successful. So we try to paint it in a very positive light, because it is a positive light. It does give us knowledge and insight as to what is going to work best for a student. And usually after an assessment is completed and we start working on, you know, just even today, there were aha moments that the parent was having, like, oh, now I understand why he's so frustrated with this, And you can have some takeaways that even tonight, when that parent is sitting down and doing homework with that child, they're going to incorporate some of those strategies. So by having the conversation that this will make us all better and help you, I think it's seen as a very positive type of experience.
I think it's so important that we go at it from the positive perspective.
Yes.
I think we worry when we say, oh, you're going to go see a psychologist, and people instantly think, oh, there's something wrong with me.
Absolutely. There's something. Yeah.
And there isn't, right? It's just that we are trying to, and I love your door and the key. Like, we're trying to find the key that fits into your door.
Right.
And we need this person's help to find that key, because we have tried, we've waited, whatever. You need something more than just pulling at every loose key that you find and go, oh, this is the one. And it's not.
Yeah. You need a roadmap. You need something that helps with you. You need a GPS or a roadmap. Another way of looking at it is it's like a poker game. The teacher has his or her cards up in front of them. The parent, the child has his, her or her cards up in front of them. And what we're trying to do is put the cards on the table so everybody sees what is knowledgeable, what we know about that kid, so that we can make important and meaningful changes for that individual.
Yeah, it's all for the benefit. So you talked briefly about teachers being involved.
Yes.
Why is it important to include teachers in part of the assessment? Because they're just the teacher. I mean, it's the parent. In this case, when we're talking about a private clinic, it's the parent. But even in the school system, it's generally the teacher. Sometimes it's the parents who request these things, but it is generally the teacher. So what information can the teacher give us that maybe a parent can't?
Well, you know, I think we should celebrate teachers, because teachers are working with our kids much more than we are with our own kids. Kids are in a school system more than they are at home, involved directly with family members in many cases. And so they're the eyes and ears of what goes on during the day. And we can't discount what they can bring to the table. They're going to see a different perspective. And just because they may see something different than what you might see at your kitchen table doesn't mean that you're not both seeing something that's very important. Even today, we saw a teacher's report that looked very different than a parent's report. Why? Because the parent does a lot of work behind the scenes that the teacher doesn't know. The teacher just sees that part. But the teacher reports some very positive things that the parent doesn't see, because the parent is frustrated with their child at that. But, you know, so it can go all different kinds of ways. Knowledge across raters, across people, and acquiring that knowledge makes it a much richer assessment. So, and also helps to provide buy-in if they're part of the process. So yeah. I do think we have to respect how much parents, as well as teachers, as well as kids, bring to the process in terms of analyzing what's going on.
It was interesting for us when we went through this to compare. We did an anxiety scale for one of our kids, and the anxiety scale at school was super, super high, but the anxiety scale at home was super, super low. And it was really interesting to hear the difference. And then as we started to understand where the struggles were and where the disconnects were, it made sense that the anxiety was much, much higher at school, because there wasn't as much support at school. Whereas at home, we were able to create the safe space and the comfortable space for him to feel successful. So it was, that's kind of why I want to highlight the fact that, you know, yes, parents are experts in their child, but your kid is really different within the four walls of their school. It's often 100%. Sometimes you can, I know sometimes I sit at parent teacher interviews and parents are like, but this isn't my child. You're describing somebody completely different, but it's because the environment is different. Exactly. The setup is different.
And we have to know those things, because sometimes tweaking an environment can make a very big difference. And so that's why it's important to have everybody's input. And it doesn't mean that a teacher or a parent is wrong in what they see. It just means that we have to analyze why the child behaves differently under these different circumstances. And it does provide insight for us to be able to help create strategies that are useful.
Is there an ideal time to do one of these assessments? Is there a time where you kind of think, oh, not yet? Or is there ever a time it's too late? And I know that's a hard question.
Well, I'm going to tell you a couple of things that are going to come to my mind. First of all, I never think it's too late. I just assessed someone who's 57 and who's had a lot of problems over their professional lives. And if they had only had an assessment earlier, we could have treated the ADHD and the learning disability that went with it. I also did somebody who was 63, the same sort of thing. So it's never too late. Although I did sort of kibosh somebody who wanted to do it at 84, that's just, you know, I feel badly, but I don't have the tools that actually go to that level. But I will say, like, there was a problem, and I do really think it's a problem in certain systems where they just feel that you shouldn't test under the age of 8. And I will tell you unequivocally that learning disabilities, if they are there, don't just show up when they're 8. We start to see patterns at a younger age. And I think we have to be proactive and on top of it if it's starting to show signs of a child not being able to keep up. Sometimes it's just skill-based, and we can tell that when it's skill-based. You know, maybe they missed the year. They had a teacher, we had one that had 4 maternity leaves in 1 year.
That's hard.
In grade 1, that's not really a learning disability. That's a skills-based issue. We can still piece that together. But especially if you've had a family history of having any learning or reading or writing or math challenges or attentional challenges, I wouldn't leave it, because the cumulative impact of somebody struggling in school for that length of time, even till when they're eight in grade two or three, is too long. You can have so much confidence, so many confidence and anxiety issues, that we start to find it harder and harder to have a kid that's invested in learning or invested in themselves. And so I wouldn't ever suggest that you wait too long. Probably the biggest time that we do get referrals is around the age of eight, between the primary and junior areas, where they're no longer learning to read and write. They have to actually apply those skills and read and write to learn. When they have to flip that switch, we get a lot of people contacting us. But I will say that there's pivotal times for an assessment. They don't have to be done every year. They should be done at the pivotal milestone, or, you know, times in a child's scholastic career. So it should start in the primary section if you're finding problems, and then somewhere in middle school so you can prepare for high school. And very critical, if they've received accommodations or require accommodations potentially for post-secondary, college or university, end of grade 11. Don't wait till grade 12, because you'll want to make sure that you're getting good selections of universities or colleges, and you want that knowledge to help drive your decision making. So this can help you prepare for what is something within your native ability scope. So it is a good time to have that. And I do want to add in something very, very, very important. Parents worry that when they do an assessment, it's going to be a stain on their record. And I tell my grade parents who have kids in grade one, I say to them, I'm going to tell you that the process is, if you came back in grade 11 or 12 and you wanted to do a reevaluation, the universities and colleges do not see your psych assessments. It's very important that you understand this. You're getting in on your transcripts based on your marks. If you've had accommodations, your marks should have been improved, because you're getting what you need to be able to showcase what you have. But they cannot see, they cannot look at you and say, oh, you know, they're not as good as someone else because they've had accommodations. They cannot see that. As a secondary process, when you apply for college or university, you can then talk to the special ed department, which is now usually called the accessibilities office, and ask for accommodations and interview them about what they offer at the post-secondary level. But they're prohibited from, you know, whispering into the registrar's ear and saying, oh, you got an assessment? Well, we don't want you. They can't do that. So I just want to assure your listeners that if they're thinking about a psych assessment, that it's not a death sentence, you know, where you just, oh no, now the school's going to know. I don't want the OSR to have this information. Knowledge is power. You know, you should feel comfortable with the assessment to share it, because like I said earlier, it's your GPS. If you don't have it, we get to the whole idea about labels. Parents are concerned about labels, and I'm extremely concerned about the wrong labels. So parents will often say, I don't want my child to be identified with ADHD. And my answer is, if you don't identify them with what they need, you may end up hearing that they're labeled as the troublemaker, the kid that's not as smart, the kid that's not trying. So label the issue with the appropriate language so that they're in a position, everyone's in the position to help and support that child. But in the absence of that information, you're not going to get a whole lot. You're going to get wrong labels.
I was, now this was back in the 80s, but I remember being the child through grade one and grade two who was sent to the principal's office to sit at the desk because I couldn't follow what was happening in class, and I was disruptive. Yeah. I was getting up. I wasn't sitting in my seat.
Me too.
You know, talking to all the other kids. I was like doing all the things other than, and then we got the assessment and we got the label, right? So I'm using air quotes. I got the label of being dyslexic, and yes, they clearly used that in the time. They moved away from it to specific language learning disability. But once I got that and I was put into a class where, you know, it was a smaller class, it was two teachers, and I was really provided with the in-depth learning that fit me and my brain, then I was able to transition into regular programming. And by the time I reached high school, I was in with everybody else. I mean, listen, it wasn't easy. I'm the first one to say I had to work harder than most of my peers, but I had learned the skills and I had been taught and I had been given the remediations that were required, and I've been able to do okay. But speaking of the psych reports, what I think I would love for you to talk about for just a few minutes, if you can, as an educator and as an administrator in my school, when an OSR comes in or when a psych ed is done by either our school psychologist or an outside psychologist, I always go to the back of the report. There's a lot of really good meaty information in the actual report, but what I want, there's two pages that I like to look at. The first page is the summary of like, what are you telling me is in all of this? Because they're often long, right? They can be upwards of 12 pages. They can be quite long. Mm-hmm. But I tend to go to sort of the summary that gives me the, okay, what is the diagnosis? What is the thing we're dealing with? Then I flip to the back couple of pages that have all those really awesome recommendations.
Yes.
And those are the things where I say to my teacher, when you have time, sure, read through the full report, knock yourself out. But right now I want you to pay attention to page, you know, the last five pages, because on that is what, tell me about those recommendations. Because I think those are the parts that I need teachers to really hone in on. But I also want parents to hone in on those, because there's a lot of information in there for them too.
I say that a report is the public accessory to what we do. And so it's very interesting and very timely that you're having this meeting with me, because I'm doing an international conference where I'm guest speaking as an individual on report writing in psychological assessments. I've been on a warpath about anti-psychobabble. We have to, as psychologists, get on the bandwagon of writing reports that are telling the story of the person behind the scores, and they should be readable by parents, educators, and clients themselves when they're old enough. And so one of the things is, I mean, we're definitely on a mission in our clinic to write stuff that explains everything. It doesn't just put numbers and names of tests in report. We put those in the back of the report in a chart, and in the front of the report, we have like the decoder ring that talks about what each section means and how it would transfer. But what you're talking about is the executive summary, often the formulation, the diagnostic formulation. And that's a very key area. And a properly written executive summary will give you the diagnosis and it will explain where it came from. So for example, if there's a learning disability, is it related to memory? Is it related to orthographic skills? I mean, I can go on and on. I don't want to confuse everybody, but there's lots of reasons why somebody has an unevenness. A learning disability is an unevenness in the way the brain is structured, such that they can't coordinate their abilities and skills to get the job done the way other people can. In the back, there should be really good strategies as well as accommodations. Strategies are things that families can use at home, teachers can use when they're working with somebody, and accommodation is a bending of the rules. It doesn't mean that you're doing any less than anybody else, but it is a situation where you're having maybe accessing the information differently, or you are producing it differently. So one of the most wonderful things for students nowadays is technology. And I'm a big, big, big believer that technology brings down the walls. So somebody who's bright like yourself, who may have had reading issues, the computer can now read to you on any level. It can read Facebook. It can read, you know, a form for you to fill out. We have kids that are completely blind that can actually take a picture of something and feel the vibration to know that they're taking the picture, and then it reads back what's on there and they can dictate answers into it. So there is so much that's beefy out there that has broken down barriers such that most kids can stay in the regular classroom with technology to help support them. So things are just, you know, we're learning as we go, and we've got all kinds of ideas and new methods to help treat them. But again, one size doesn't fit all. Ask any woman who buys pantyhose. Like, it just doesn't work. What we want to do is we want to make sure that the assessment brings to light the strengths of that individual so that you can appeal to those strengths to help get those other areas boosted. And so that's what the recommendations should be. They should not be cookie cutter. They should be specific. to the needs of that particular individual. And I do want to say there is room also for some individuals for modifications. And modifications mean that they can't necessarily keep up with the curriculum as it is. And so they may need to have the expectations modified. Modifications might mean for somebody that has, let's say, a severe language-based disorder, it may mean that they have to have things read to them or have to work at a slightly lower level. There is room in the report for those kinds of things, modifications. But I'd say 90% of the assessments are going to be accommodations, just bending of the rules and leveling the playing field so it's much fairer for the kid to step up to the plate.
Yeah, those accommodations can make a big difference too. And they can be really simple things. It can be, you know, as simple as adding technology, as simple as allowing the child to complete the test or the assignment verbally instead of having to write it. The information is there. Whether they can tell it to you, whether they can write it to you, it doesn't matter. They know it. They have the information in their brain. It's like I was doing the math work with my son this afternoon and he has terrible penmanship. Writing is hard for him. So I said to him, fine, you tell me what the mathematical answers are. You go through the process. I will write it down. He's still having to subtract the number. He's still having to borrow and carry and do the actual operational part of it. I'm just the pen.
Yeah.
That's all.
And I think, you know, and then eventually the computer or iPad can become the pen once they're more comfortable. But I want to give you another example of a very simple accommodation that goes against the grain of what we were trained to do. And that is, let's say you're talking about math. For a lot of students, more practices is actually working against them. It's counterproductive. So an accommodation that I might make for a kid that's reasonably bright and understands the concepts is that I might say to them, here's 10 math questions. I want you to do the uneven ones. And if you do them correctly, you don't have to do any more. So it challenges them to step up to the plate, especially if they have like an attention disorder, to actually focus on what they're learning. And in that time, that precious time where they're actually doing the work properly, they're taking in way more than, let's say, somebody that's been given 20 questions because they just figure they have to practice more. So it doesn't work for all people, but sometimes we have to adjust what we do a little bit to get more out of our kids.
I'm wondering about how do parents approach telling their child about their difference, their learning difference? How do you have that conversation? What's kind of your guide to how we as parents should explain it to them?
I think it all depends on the kid's age. And I liken this to having a conversation to them about sex. Like you know,
it's very awkward. Nobody's comfortable and you don't want to give too much information.
Yep. You don't want to give too much information. So what I often say is with our younger kids, after they've completed the assessment, we have a conversation. And sometimes the psychologist like myself will talk with them at their level and answer questions as they ask them rather than just assume that I can give them everything, like with the sex metaphor. So I often just say to them, listen, you know, I found out you're super smart. You understand how to do Lego. You understand how to build things. That's really important. People need to build things and know how to put things together. And I understand this. These areas are harder for you, like listening or maybe remembering stuff. So we've got some tricks that are going to help you. Do we use the term learning disability with younger kids? No, we wouldn't necessarily say that yet because I don't know if they understand the label. And so what we'll do is we'll wait till they're older and ready. Just like the conversation with sex, they're going to start off at different levels and be ready at different levels. But often middle school time is a good time to start talking about that. And we'll talk about what a learning disability is and that it's not disabling. It's just telling us that things can be more effortful under certain circumstances. And I often use myself as an example. But I didn't have the benefit of being tested. And so I just went through life sometimes really struggling to get things done. And it wasn't until graduate school that we realized what was going on. But I would tell them that I wouldn't want you to have that kind of struggle. Life is, we can level the playing field and you can be much more successful. And we often talk about the strategies and technology tools for the kid, and they get so psyched about it that they realize that the name, the learning disability or the ADHD that they might have is a means to an end. It's telling them that when you have that diagnosis, it opens doors. It actually doesn't shut doors, because now it's incumbent upon the school to be responsible for providing accommodations. They're on, you know, the hot seat to provide accommodations, as long as, you know, we can't accommodate everything out. Like, we have to be reasonable. But I tell them, and they get usually really excited when they find out, oh, I can have more time. Oh, you know, I have problems with oral, like when I have to do oral presentations, you mean that I could do them at home and pre-record them and edit them before I bring them in? And yeah. So often we find that kids are not upset about learning this. They actually would like to know why they're having a challenge, and they would really appreciate knowing what they can do to support themselves. And most of the time, they take it extremely well.
I think it's nice to understand why you are the way you are. For me, it was being able to understand why school was hard, why writing was hard, why reading was hard, why I took, you know, longer to do an assignment than my peers, and being able to have a reference for that. That was so, so important.
And it validates you. I think if we ignore it, we ignore how you feel. And so assessments can help be very validating to individuals. It tells them that we're listening. We heard that it's hard, and now we have a reason, and it explains it.
For me growing up, I mean, my parents, it's funny. I always think, I'm like, and I guess it was because I was in a small class placement. And so the question for me always was, why are my friends in these big classes of 20 or 30 and I'm in this small class? And so that probably would have been the discussion, but there isn't that so much anymore. I mean, my two boys have never been in a small class placement. They've always been in the big class. What has worked in their favor a little bit is they have a mom who is dyslexic, who is a special education teacher. And we just use the label.
Yes.
Reading is hard because you're dyslexic, because you have trouble with the letters and the sounds that they create. And then being able to help them understand why it is they're doing reading tutoring twice a week at an intensive level.
And they know that it's genetic. It is, right. It is, there's actually mutations on genes that they've been able to identify for all kinds of disorders. So This isn't just in our heads. You know, that
I had a math teacher in teacher's college. I remember going to him and I said, you know, I struggle with math, and learning to teach math might be a bit of a struggle. Please bear with me. And he's like, well, your learning disability is all in your head. You don't really have it. And I just sort of looked at him and thought, okay, this is how this is going to go down.
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is break down those barriers and understand the legitimacy of these learning disorders. They're not, everybody has an unevenness. There's no question. Some people are artistic, as we said earlier, some people may be mathematical. Yeah, everybody has strengths and slightly weaker areas. The difference is when they're so vastly different from other people, that they're not just a slight, you know, up and down in your profile, but they're actually disabling to some extent. You know, you sit, like, for example, the person who chronically loses their car, they can't read maps. That can be disabling, and it can transfer to other things. Dyslexia isn't about poor teaching. It's about having problems. And even in dyslexia, there's different kinds. There's, there's surface dyslexia, which affects the orthographic pictorial aspect of it. There's also phonological dyslexia, and there's also mixed, where it's both. And then there's also things that look like dyslexia that aren't, whether it's an attention, a memory, a verbal ability problem. That's where we have to get to the crux of it, because without that, we really can't account for why it's happening. And when we don't know precisely what brain mechanisms are involved, we're not going to be very effective in our treatment strategies.
Well, and teachers can't be effective in the way in which they support the child, and neither can the education system. I mean, if we as teachers are working with the parent and we're all stabbing at the dark saying, oh, maybe this will work, maybe that'll work, we actually end up wasting more time. because mm-hmm. we're waiting for some magical thing to happen. Whereas when we're lucky enough to get these reports done by the school, or if families are lucky enough to be able to do the tests privately, the information that we get out of that is really invaluable. Even if it comes back saying the child is fine and there really isn't.
That's right.
I mean, you know, even those assessments have value, and that information always gives us the strengths, but then also the areas that need improvement. And so how can we use those strengths, those things that the student is very, very good at, to help with the things that aren't so great? And how do mm-hmm. we piggyback those things to create a successful outcome? I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit, and this question might be a bit hard because I know that depending on what you're assessing for and all that will change, but parents can't be in the room with their child as they're doing these assessments.
Correct.
And one of the ones, I remember when my kids were going into it, I said, oh, you get to play games. And I told them about the only one thing that I remember, except for having to remember sequence of orders, numbers backwards and forwards, which was never fun for me, but.
Or for the examiner, just saying.
Oh, really? You have to do. Oh, but there was one that I remember, and I don't know if they still do it. It was cubes, and they were red and white.
Yeah.
And there was a picture, and I had to move the cubes. One of my kids loved that one.
Yes.
One of my kids was like, what was that red and white cube, and why are you making me do that? So what are some of the assessments that the kid, like in terms of practically, like what are you putting them through? Because I'm imagining parents are like, well, great, my kid goes into this room for 2 hours. I have no idea what they're doing. I'd be curious to know, what is it that you're looking at? What are you using?
So when we get into the intellect, like, first of all, we don't do all of, like, let's say memory all together. We don't want to overwhelm them. So we try to, in our clinic anyway, and it's not always the case in a school-based assessment because they just don't have time. But what we do is we tend to do cross-battery work. That means that if we're doing memory testing on one day, we'll do it on another day to look at the differences. So even in memory, there's things like, yes, you have to hear things, remember things that are verbal, that are related to a story, that are meaningful, that are not meaningful, things that you have to juggle in your head, like numbers forwards and backwards, things that you see and remember, things that you see and things that are rotated that you see. So memory is, for example, there's short-term memory, there's longer-term memory, there's verbal memory, there's visual memory, there is learned memory. There's a lot of different things. And the kinds of activities that you could do with, you know, intellectual things, there's also things that have to do with language. How can you categorize information? How can you see the similarities in a concept? How can you define vocabulary words? How can you put together words to make a sentence versus how well can you assemble something from a diagram like IKEA or Lego? How well can you make predictions based on visual details that you're given, relates to math skills? There's a lot of activities. And we've gone to also a situation where we've done virtual testing because of COVID, as well as in-person testing and a hybrid part. We've actually been able to do over 400 assessments that have a virtual assessment component. And we've picked up new tools along the way. Necessity is the mother of invention. And we've learned some really cool games that are done on a computer. So it really depends. There's still typical reading, writing, and math, but there's also games where they're word games, or there's, like I said, sometimes they're building games. They really differ. And then as we get closer to understanding that child, we may want to do more areas, investigate them to get across days and across examiners even. We want to make sure we're getting the same results. So we're not just coming up with a whole hypothesis based on a single subtest. We want to see an integration from what the parent says, what the kid reports, what the teacher sees, what the data shows us, and under different circumstances, even with attention span. For example, attention memory can look very different with a kid with ADHD versus somebody who has a memory problem. So you have to know all those things. So it's kind of complex. We like to build our assessments based on what the child is presenting as needs and continue that investigation. But they're usually pretty playful until we get to the reading, writing, and math. we try to make it playful, but for a lot of kids, that's like nails on a board.
You know? The puzzles were always fine. Puzzles have never been a problem for me, but it was once we started getting into the reading, the writing, and the math. It's funny how you remember certain things about the assessments. I mean, I will say to parents out there who are like, oh, it's, you know, my child is going to be devastated by this. It's really not that bad. I mean, it's a few hours of, you know, not a whole lot of fun, but the people who've always done mine and done my children's have always tried to make it fun. So
yeah, we try to make it fun. And the other thing that we do is once we decide based on the data that comes out and the kid's own input, we figure out what the kid likes and is good at versus what they're not as good at. And so we try to do a couple of subtests that are kind of nasty that they don't like, and then right away put in stuff that's really successful for them. So we really try to tweak an assessment to build on their strengths so that they don't leave feeling depleted. So if we know that they're bad readers, we're going to make sure that we're going to spread that out. We're going to throw in some nice, juicy, fun stuff in between that we know that they're really good at.
Okay, let's talk about sharing this report. So parents have gone through the trouble of either having it done through the school, in which case it's going to get shared with the school. There isn't really a question. I mean, if the school does the assessment, by and large, generally, unless the parent requests it not be shared, we tend to have access to it. But if families do the assessment privately, do they share it? Should they share it? Are there cases where they shouldn't share it? What are your thoughts, or how should parents navigate that? Because that also can be really hard. If you get really devastating information, the question then becomes, do I really want to share it? And quite frankly, the sharing of that information, at least from my perspective, in the case with my own boys, made it real. Once I shared it with the school, there was definitely a sense of like, oi, okay, yeah, this is actually a thing. And there's some work that we need to do. So that being said, it's a heavy document to give away. You feel like you're giving your children, literally handing your children to these people and being like, okay, I hope you know what you're doing. So I'm curious to hear if you have any thoughts on the idea of to share, to not to share the whole thing, share parts of it. How do we navigate that?
I'm going to tell you a couple of things. A properly constructed assessment should help put together all the puzzle pieces for a parent and the school system. And so if it's properly balanced with the strengths of a child, as well as with the needs, and have meaningful recommendations and accommodations, if it was my own child, and, you know, I would share it, because that knowledge is power. And without that knowledge, people are not able to do what they need to do to get the job done. And so, like we talked about labels before, if you don't provide the school system with evidence-based information, then they're constantly poking at the kid with maybe the wrong key and breaking the key in the lock in the meantime. So sometimes information is hard and you don't want to share it. But you have to ask yourself, what's the consequence of somebody not having the appropriate information to help you? I like to say that this makes schools more accountable when they have the information. If they don't have the information, nothing sticks, because they can say they just didn't know how to support your kid. So I think a properly constructed assessment should be shared in its entirety. Now, there are certain circumstances where I won't write a report and take out important things. I will create a properly balanced and honest assessment and report. But there are sometimes pieces of family information that are very delicate. And as a psychologist, you have to ask yourself, is this going to be worthwhile to expose in a report or put it in separate case notes? And so there are certain things that I think it's incumbent upon the psychologist to take ownership for and understand, is this going to be helpful for the kid or not, if it's a very delicate family situation, for example. And so I think that you can ask a psychologist about certain sections that you may have revealed to them about. Maybe there's abuse, maybe the child had been assaulted, who knows? Do you want that in the report, or would you rather that it's alluded to as traumatic incidents in the report? Like, we can deal with it in a way where we don't have to spell out every single personal raw piece of data that we collect. So you have a right to ask your psychologist, you know, to be fair and about it, but We cannot write out diagnoses. Some parents will say to us, make a report, but I don't want it to say ADHD in the report. And I'll say to them, the problem with that is it's like taking a lab result and then whiting it out and just saying it doesn't exist. I can't do that. That's not fair for your child. We have to tell what it is. And well, of course, you have the right to share or not, but if it's done, a properly constructed psych assessment should be more helpful than not. And if you do it privately, yes, you can remove it. They don't have to keep it in the OSR. In fact, actually, school-based assessments do not need to be kept in a public record if you request not to. What they do mark on the Section H of the folder of the Ontario Student Record is that it was done and that Psychological Services has it, but they can't reveal what's in it. So you still have privacy rights.
Yep. Parents have lots of rights around, even if you do one within the school system, right? There's lots of rights around what is shared, what isn't shared, what's in the document, what's not. I mean, any psychologist who is doing this correctly is ensuring the security and safety of the child and that this document is to benefit the child. So I think that's the big message of today is that really these documents benefit the child.
Yes.
They're not meant to do harm. And what they do for us in terms of an educational perspective is it really gives us a great window into who that child is as a learner and what it is that we as the school should be putting in place to ensure that child's success. Because that's really what we want.
I actually say to parents, keep a copy of it on your phone. Yeah. And especially if the executive summary is done correctly and succinctly, just to remind yourself. And I actually say about the third or fourth week of school of a new school year, go in and review the assessment with that teacher to ensure that the teacher understands, because sometimes these IEPs are developed and just recycled year after year, but nobody really understands. And so I think that we can't blame teachers for misunderstanding a child if they've got 30 other kids in the classroom. Parents do need to have some documentation to support that they want and are hopeful that the teacher can accommodate their child.
Yeah. And IEPs, individual education plans, are a whole other podcast recording. That's a whole other, this is one topic.
Yes, ma'am.
It all relates, but that's a whole other podcast recording.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, where can parents go to learn more about psychoeducational assessments? I mean, we've had a great discussion here, but are there good places for parents to go and learn information?
The Learning Disabilities Association of Ontario, LDAO, has done a pretty good job, actually a very good job, of discussing about assessments and so on. I think that there are other places. I know that there's different ADHD groups that have also discussed about it. I know I've presented at a couple of LDAO and ADHD groups about assessments. They can, unfortunately, a lot of family doctors and, you know, they may or may not be able to explain them in terms of knowing all the details, but I will say that more and more doctors are on board about this, and we're getting a lot of referrals from doctors who recognize that this is beyond their scope, especially when there's ADHD involved. They just don't know the comorbid features that might be a part of it, but they're much more supportive of psychological assessments than they used to be. We use those two things, psychoeducational and psychological assessments. We use them together.
I always say to my clients, start with your family doctor, get them to refer you to, if they're very young, a developmental assessment. So go see a developmental pediatrician, start there. And that tends to kind of start opening doors to the next set of things. All right, Melissa, where can people learn more about your clinic and what happens there?
They can go to CornerPsych, CornerPsych, which stands for Cornerstone Psychology. So, cornerpsych.com or cornerpsych.ca. We're located in Thornhill in the Promenade Mall.
Melissa, thank you so much for this conversation tonight. I appreciate it. I learned a few things I didn't realize, and I really hope that the listeners feel like they have a better understanding. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for making me think about all this stuff. This is important for me too.
Thanks so
much. Continue doing the work that you're doing. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are looking for help and support in creating a roadmap to success for your child through challenging times, contact me at access2education.com. I work with all families to help them build power and knowledge in understanding their child's needs and how to build success through advocacy. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at access2education Toronto. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so together we can create your roadmap to success.